Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Kars for the petitioner, Daniel Sanders, and I'd like to request a 4 minutes rebuttal, please.
Pardon me?
4 minutes rebuttal.
All right. So try to keep track of your own 4 minutes.
I will do that, Your Honor. First, let me take care of one preliminary matter. A supplemental authorities was filed with the court today. I found some research, and I thought it was appropriate, especially there is a Ninth Circuit case on the matter of appeal after trial.
Yes.
Okay. This is a case about credibility, and it's about credibility of the complaining witness's mother. But I think that I'd like to focus at least initially on the pretrial hearing in the state court level, and the reason being, for one, the district court admitted that if the pretrial hearing had found the hearsay comments inadmissible, there would not have been sufficient evidence to go to trial and to obtain a conviction. There were three hearsay witnesses, and in order of presentation, they were the mother, Patty Sue Kelly, the detective, Detective Folsom, and then Dr. Sterling. This took place, the critical initial discussion was with Patty Sue Kelly, the mother. And then about over a period of time, which admittedly at least 8 hours for the full disclosure to come out. It was the next day, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe, that there was the interviews of the 3-year-old child with Detective Folsom and Dr. Sterling. Now, in the focus of the trial court's analysis of the Ryan factors, which were critical to determining whether or not the hearsay in the state of Washington is admissible, they were looking at basically 9 factors. And I have made the argument in my paper that if further information had come before the trial court at the pretrial hearing, the hearsay would not have been admissible. And specifically, it comes to the issue of the credibility of the initial hearsay witness, Patty Sue Kelly, and the potential impact of her actions upon the testimony of her son, who was then subsequently interviewed. Evidence was presented at the district court to show various elements of Patty Sue Kelly and the ineffectiveness of trial counsel by not interviewing or calling as witnesses certain individuals who Patty Sue Kelly had related the story as allegedly told to her by the young man. And in particularly, I draw this court's attention to two names in particular who did not know Patty Sue Kelly before this whole episode. That would be Patrick Dixon of the Department of Social and Health Services and Officer Denham, I believe, of the Clark County Sheriff's Department. Now, in the statements by Patty Sue Kelly to these two individuals, we have very interestingly elements that go right to the trial court's discussion of the admissibility of the statements. For example, the use of the word pee-pee versus penis. Now, that in and of itself may not seem all that much, but there seems to be, for example, in the subsequent testimony to Dr. Sterling and Detective Folsom, there was every language and every word that Tyler used to describe, allegedly describe the events of that day used the word penis. And yet she specifically used, and it was documented, that the word that she described that Tyler said to her, to these two individuals, was pee-pee. Now, we cannot expect a trial court to be prescient. That would be absurd. But we can expect, when this documentation is part of the discovery package, that these people with this very important critical information would be called to put into question the initial hearsay witness's testimony. And that is the gravamen of what I'm talking about. For example, when the mother talked to Patrick Dixon, she said it happened at night. Now, one of the consistencies is that there were towels involved. When she talked to Officer Denham, it was daytime in the bathroom. Now, most of the other testimony suggests that the alleged incident occurred in the bedroom. But then, of course, subsequent testimony or subsequent statements to Cindy Taylor said otherwise. The point is that the trial court, when it was looking at just the three witnesses alone, just looked at them, and it did not have enough information to adequately address the question of whether or not the statements were consistent. And that really is the problem here, because if the trial court had been presented testimony to show that they're basically inconsistent or that Hattie Sue Kelly is critically impeachable on her veracity, and if it had been shown that, for example, that her and my client, Mr. Sanders, had an animosity, she had a propensity to make these accusations, all of these issues would have put into question some of the issues that come out in the Ryan factors, as discussed in State v. Swan. And that is really the initial issue. And I think it's critical because, like I said, they don't come in. There is no case. Now, even understanding that there is some similarities, then that goes to the question of, you know, a young child, 3 years old, susceptibility. You know, it seems like, I mean, to me anyway, it's a distinct possibility that over a period of time there developed a story, the story was imprinted, and that came out during the subsequent interviews with Detective Folsom and Dr. Sterling. And that's the issue. That was the issue that wasn't raised. And that's the problem, because if you take a look at the transcript of the decision by the trial court judge at the pretrial hearing, you can see that there's some real, you know, he depended heavily on what was presented, which is right, but he had no option or no opportunity to consider any other evidence because defense counsel didn't do anything. I mean, Professor Strait testified as an expert for Mr. Sanders, and specifically made the point that at that point in the trial process, there was no downside to following up on these things. No downside whatsoever. We have two critical missing witnesses that go expressly to the veracity of Hattie Sue Kelly. Where were they? There are some other issues that could have been brought up at the same time regarding the fact that Hattie Sue Kelly had said to Officer Denham that my client had put his penis in her mouth, in his mouth, and yet that's nowhere else in the testimony. There's a real inconsistency because you would think that a young child who had had that happen to them would have expressed it again and again and again. That raises real questions about, you know, how consistent the statements are. There's also an issue in the Ryan factors. If the court gets beyond that point, which requires corroboration. Now, this is discussed in a couple of different cases, and it really, you know, in all honesty, I mean, this is an issue for that the trial courts have a fair amount of leeway, and I'd be the first to admit it, because they have to. But let us look at what the corroboration said. The corroboration said precocious knowledge. However, the question of what was the precocious knowledge if the statements were inconsistent, that kind of raises an issue, and the court even admitted on record that as far as the corroboration, that was a questionable issue, but it did weigh on the side of the state. So the question then comes in, if had more evidence come in, would it have been gone? And so there's, for example, the masturbation gesture, allegedly masturbation gesture, that was allegedly made to Detective Folsom. But in Detective Folsom, the evidentiary hearing admitted that at least the hand gestures that he used could be considered leading. And so the point is that where was this questioning 3-year-old susceptibility?
It's just I understand your point here. I mean, the testimony given by the officer to the trial judge, as I recall, reflected the conversation or the question, the discussion he had with the little boy. And that seems to me would have reflected exactly the leading nature. I mean, I'm not sure what it is that you're saying the lawyer should have been bringing out about that.
Well, what I would say is this, is that, I think your point being that the judge, who's obviously a trial judge, would have the opportunity to see what a leading question is or not.
And more than that, evaluate it. I mean, you have a discussion with a 3-year-old, the odds are pretty good there are going to be some leading questions in there, but you make an evaluation as to how reliable the responses are, and the judge is sitting there making that evaluation. I'm not sure exactly what it is you're saying the defense counsel should have done about that.
Well, I think that I mean, you know, judges need help. We all need help. And that sometimes there's things that we miss that can be brought to their attention, to our attention, that would assist us in evaluating the evidence. And so if, you know, it's not brought to the judge's attention, they may make an assumption and not see it in a light that would then be presented appropriately.
But what you're saying really is that in the nature of small children, unlike maybe your average witnesses, that what's leading and what's not leading would be enhanced by an expert who could talk about that subject, which wasn't there, or there was no one to help the judge other than just your normal, you know, leading or non-leading. I mean, you made an assumption before about, well, you would assume that children would do such and such, or would testify if told this, that they would do it again and again. And I know that that's not necessarily true. I know experts would tell you that wouldn't be necessarily true. So if I take your point, I think it's that you're saying there needs to be, there wasn't enough done to pinpoint the situation with this very young child as a witness.
I think that's a point well taken. The point of, you know, we did have an expert in child interview techniques at the evidentiary hearing. Well, actually, it was a week after because he had been in the hospital. But that type of expert, I mean, it's a very difficult thing dealing with a 3-year-old child. I mean, what's truth? What isn't truth? What's their level of veracity? What's their level of understanding? As the expert brought up in his testimony, the use of the word sprinkled. Where did that come from? I mean, that's a fairly complex word for a 3-year-old. I mean, these kind of questions. I mean, the word, which words they use around the house, the fact the child couldn't identify the word buttocks when shown the picture. I mean, and so, yes, I do believe strongly that an expert in a situation like this would be critical. And I think that point was well taken by Professor Strait, who had examined this issue and put together a protocol precisely for this area.
And the concern I have about the professor's testimony is it seemed to me he presented not the broad range of professional competence type tests that Strickland gives us, but what should be done. And we have testimony about a protocol to be utilized in dealing with child witnesses, and that at least somebody within the county was familiar with that and used it. But that seems to me to be a far cry from testimony that establishes the broad range of professional competence, which is the standard we have to deal with here. So let me just put it in a very broad fashion. What tells us that what was done by defense counsel here is outside what, you know Strickland's language, you won't try to dig it up and waste your time, outside that broad band, the deferential standard we're supposed to apply.
Okay, can I ask a limiting question?
Sure.
Because, I mean, if we're
talking
about...
I mean, I'd answer it, but you can ask.
If we're talking about experts, that's one issue. If we're talking about calling witnesses...
Why don't you just tell Judge Clifton the entire package of why you think this lawyer, who didn't file a brief, didn't make an argument, didn't say anything, didn't call any witnesses, tell him why you think his performance is below the level of competence required under Strickland.
Because there is no reason, no rational reason, to not call witnesses at a pretrial hearing to challenge child hearsay statements in a case like this, in any case, in any case, in a general way, in any case involving a child who is 3 years old, that is what I'm talking about. That's the crux of the question, or one of the questions, you know. The other thing is that one of some of the other evidence, I'm getting short on time, but I want to just point out that also at the pretrial hearing, there was absolutely no discussion of the of the DNA evidence, the missing DNA evidence on the towels, and the judge specifically drew a connection and used the stains as corroboration, and yet, as pointed out in the evidentiary hearing, much much more clearly, that there was no good reason for there not to be stains based upon the fact that Tyler had said that he had been washed with towels and his mom had collected the clothes and they had been transferred appropriately in a very quick fashion. I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. My name is Greg Rosen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondent, Leslie Ryder, in this matter. Mr. Sanders was not provided with ineffective assistance of counsel by his trial attorney, Tom LaDucer. This Court previously remanded this matter after oral argument for an evidentiary hearing on the merits of Mr. Sanders' IAC claims. In a 27-page decision, a report and recommendation, Magistrate Judge Arnold determined that Mr. Sanders was not provided with ineffective assistance of counsel. And in a 19-page decision adopting the R&R, District Judge Bryan found that Mr. Sanders was not deprived of a fair trial or that the result of his trial was unreliable. And when this Court reviews the District Court's findings of fact, it does so under the clearly erroneous standard. I would respectfully submit that this Court should defer to the District Court's factual findings in this case. Now, counsel has argued essentially that Patty Sue Kelly forms the crux of this case. This case turns on Mr. LaDucer's alleged failure to impeach what he viewed to be a critical witness, specifically Patty Sue Kelly. And because Mr. LaDucer failed to adequately impeach Ms. Kelly, then all the child hearsay came in, and as a result, Mr. Sanders was convicted. I would respectfully disagree with that contention for a number of reasons. First, the focus of a Ryan hearing is to determine whether there is adequate indicia of reliability for the child hearsay statements, not the reliability or credibility to whom those child hearsay statements are made. Tyler's core statement never changed.
He said that he was told to say what he said by his mother.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He said that he was told to say what he said by his mother.
In one aspect of the hearing, he did say that. That's true.
So that her credibility is not, you know, an unrelated factor. His story came out, apparently, according to his mother, over a period of time after she talked to him. And then he said, yes, that she had talked to him about his testimony, and he was saying what she said. So her credibility seems to be of some significance.
Even if that's true, Your Honor, what is being missed by counsel, and I hope this Court does not miss it, is that Patty Sue Kelly was not the only witness at this Ryan hearing. And the reason the child hearsay came in and the reason Mr. Sanders was ultimately convicted was because of the child hearsay statements uttered to Dr. Sterling and Detective Folsom. And Detective Folsom's testimony at the evidentiary hearing made clear, and I believe also at the trial, is that many of Tyler's spontaneous nonverbal movements are critically important. And I think Mr. Carrs touched on some of those nonverbal movements, and I'll just allude to them briefly. Tyler showed Detective Folsom a masturbation gesture by partially closing his right hand. Now, if Patty Sue Kelly told him what to do, is it reasonable to infer that she also rehearsed and orchestrated a nonverbal movement like holding? A three-year-old will hold out his hand in a partially closed manner, imitating a masturbation gesture? I would submit not. Additionally, Tyler, when speaking with Detective Folsom, said that penis touched me and spontaneously touched his right cheek twice with his hand, is it reasonable to infer that Patty Sue Kelly, if she had told Tyler what to say, would also orchestrate those two spontaneous movements where a 3-year-old would spontaneously touch his right cheek? I would submit not. Additionally, Detective Folsom testified that in speaking with Tyler, and I believe I'm getting this correctly, that Detective Folsom showed Tyler this image of a finger pointing down over his thumb. Tyler corrected him, and he was asked, is this what Dan's penis looked like? And he said, no, it pointed up. And that, too, was a spontaneous movement that I would submit that Patty Sue Kelly could not reasonably have orchestrated or rehearsed with Tyler. Now, even if this court assumes that Ms. Little-Deucer was arguably deficient by not competently impeaching Ms. Kelly at the Ryan hearing, as I've said, Tyler's child hearsay statements are still going to come in based on the strength of Dr. Sterling's testimony and Detective Folsom. And Dr. Sterling testified that Tyler was asked by him if Sanders had sprinkled water. Tyler said no and then said, yucky water. And when asked where the yucky water came from, Tyler stated quickly, from his penis. And Tyler corrected Dr. Sterling twice about where the event occurred. He asked him, did this happen in the kitchen? And Tyler corrected him. And he said, no, in Gabe's bedroom. And I would submit that Patty Sue Kelly, even if she spoke with Tyler regarding this incident, the fact that Tyler corrected Dr. Sterling on two occasions makes clear that there wasn't adequate indicia of reliability as to the child hearsay statements offered by Tyler. Now, the district court properly found that even if Patty Sue Kelly had been competently impeached, I would submit that even if Ms. Kelly had been competently impeached at the Ryan hearing, that impeachment would only have addressed one Ryan factor, and that's number 5. And that's another reason why Ms. Kelly is not the crux of this case. Even if she had been, in Mr. Carr's words, adequately impeached, that knocks out one Ryan factor, and that's the 5th one, the timing of the declaration and the relationship between the declarant and the witness. So even if, arguably, Mr. Leducer had adequately impeached Ms. Kelly and showed Ms. Kelly to be about as non-credible a witness as you can find, well, we've knocked out one Ryan factor of the 9. And the state is not required to demonstrate that all the Ryan factors have been met.
Only one Ryan factor has dropped out? I mean, the spontaneity is kind of tempered, is it not, by Kelly's infusion and discussion with the child. I mean, so there may be some spontaneity, but there's also other testimony that directed where it was going. So, I mean, I'm just having trouble understanding why that is just not a factor to be considered at all.
Well, it certainly is a factor to be considered, Your Honor. But as I said, even if you find that Ms. Kelly was inadequately impeached by Mr. Leducer, setting that aside, Dr. Sterling had a separate conversation with Tyler. Dr. Sterling, to use a colloquial phrase, has been around the block in terms of doing sexual abuse investigations as a pediatrician. He was Tyler's pediatrician. Tyler had a separate conversation with Detective Folsom outside the presence of Ms. Kelly. Those are both professionals. One's a police officer, one's a pediatrician. These conversations didn't occur with Ms. Kelly seated in a chair while the discussion was going on with Tyler. They were outside the presence of Ms. Kelly. So I would submit that that lends sufficient indicia of credibility, an adequate indicia of credibility for the admission of the child hearsay. Ms. Kelly, my point is, this case does not turn on Ms. Kelly, and I hope this court does not apply a myopic approach in that regard. There were other witnesses at Ryan, and it was on the testimony of Sterling and Folsom that the hearsay came in. And there were questions offered to Mr. Carrs before as to the fact that Mr. Leducer submitted no brief. Mr. Leducer offered no argument at the Ryan hearing. Mr. Leducer testified during the evidentiary hearing, which took as this Court may recall, 6 days to complete after the remand. And Ms. LaDucer testified that if there was an argument to be made, he would have made it. If there wasn't, then he was left with that. And what Mr. Sanders cannot show is prejudice. He cannot show that there's a reasonable probability that the outcome of his Ryan hearing would have been different based on Mr. LaDucer's alleged deficiencies. He doesn't
think you accept the proposition that if the outcome had been different, that's going to be enough to establish prejudice because there's not the key testimony you need for a conviction. So you're focused on what the result of the hearing itself would have been.
Well, as the Supreme Court has told us in Lockhart v. Fredwell, the prejudice inquiry doesn't end with an outcome determination alone. He has the burden of demonstrating that his trial was fundamentally unfair or the result was unreliable.
Well, let's jump to the result. I mean, can you contemplate a trial that would produce a guilty verdict if Tyler's testimony, the hearsay version of Tyler's testimony, was excluded?
No.
So fundamentally, the argument now is that the trial judge would have reached the same result after the Ryan hearing that he did. That's what you're basing argument on.
I'm saying that based on the entirety of the testimony during the Ryan hearing, which included Ms. Kelly's testimony as well as Dr. Sterling's and Detective Folsom's, that there was an adequate indicia of reliability and the trial court's finding was a proper one.
Let me pose to you the question, or really the answer that was given a few moments ago, Mr. Carrs, in terms of, or he says, you know, what's the downside? Why doesn't the defense attorney present some of the other witnesses or argue to the trial court? Maybe he doesn't need to submit a brief because the judge already knows the elements, but I mean, the argument was extremely brief. Essentially, there wasn't an argument made that I could find in oral form either. And is there a downside to making an argument, given that everybody had to understand that Tyler's testimony was critical?
Well, I think the downside is, and I'm sure you're aware of this yourself, Your Honor, is that if you make an argument which on its face has no merit, I think you run the risk of alienating the court and destroying your intellectual credibility before the court. There are obviously arguments that every attorney can make in any particular case, and one of the jobs of an attorney is to exercise his or her judgment and determine which of these arguments has merit. Do I want to get up there and flap my gums, essentially, just to make an argument so I could say, well, I tried everything I could. I said what I could, even though I know in my heart that argument is baseless. And there's no indication, and the district court found this, that even if Mr. LaDucer had a more aggressive advocacy regarding the Ryan hearing, regarding either arguing factors, submitting a brief, or calling witnesses, that the result would have been different. And I would respectfully submit that the district court's finding in that regard was correct.
But if that's not a finding that we owe deference to, I mean, that's not really a factual finding. That's kind of
it's a conclusion of law.
A legal conclusion trying to figure out what the situation is.
I agree.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It is difficult to understand. You say a lawyer shouldn't make a bad argument. It's difficult to understand where everyone must have known that the whole key to this case was that evidentiary hearing. The prosecution understood that, put on at least 6 witnesses. I think at least 7 witnesses. The defendant's lawyer could, Judge Clifton said, well, maybe you don't need a brief because the judge knows the law. Maybe you don't need witnesses, experts. You don't need any kind of witnesses. And then you don't make an argument. I don't know why you need a lawyer. Surely a lawyer could have done something in defense in this case.
Is that true? Is it true that in every case, Your Honor, a lawyer could do something? Is that true based upon the evidence that's before the court? I don't know if that necessarily follows. You have the evidence. Every
I would think, I bet you could have done something. I think where the evidence is a 3-year-old and there's a very odd relationship between the 3-year-old's mother and you, and both have somewhat shady characters, and it all depends on whether a 3-year-old child's put up to something by the mother or not, I would think you'd be able to put on some kind of a defense. You wouldn't just sit back and say, well, you know, Judge, you know how to handle these cases. No point in my saying anything or doing anything.
Well, I go back to my premise, and I don't know if I respectfully disagree with your premise, Your Honor, but I don't know that if a lawyer can do something in every case. I don't know if that's really borne out by the reality of trial practice.
Well, I'll give, in this case, just even looking at the transcript of the trial, the evidence, the DNA issue, for instance, they come in and they tell you there's no DNA on the towels or the washcloths or any of that, and wouldn't you want to talk to an expert and say, is this normal? Can it just disappear? Shouldn't we say it would be there if there'd been DNA? Wouldn't you bring in witnesses to say that this mother's always fabricated stories? Apparently there were people who were willing to say that. But not to put on any evidence at all?
Well, you could bring in a DNA expert, and then, as the district court correctly found, you really emphasize the DNA evidence. And you also emphasize the fact that Mr. Sanders lied about masturbating.
Well, that's all there. I mean, that's all there. The question is, you know, that she saved the washcloth, saved the towel, which supposedly had this, and by the time it got to the lab, it was all gone.
It seems to me there the question is there a difference between cross-examining and getting the expert to admit that he couldn't actually say there was any DNA on there? That different than, say, bringing in your own expert who says this whole degradation theory is highly unlikely and definitely nobody can say what it is. You know, we're kind of in this situation of whether his kind of tepid cross-examination is the same as bringing in an affirmative witness. I think most lawyers would say, well, there is a difference between the two.
Well, I would submit that Mr. LaDucer acted reasonably when he stipulated to the admissibility of DNA evidence. Sanders had already lied about masturbating, and then I believe he said actually to Detective Folsom, as God is my witness, I didn't masturbate, and then came clean and said, yeah, I not only masturbated in the bathroom, masturbated in the bedroom too, and there were semen samples found in both. Yeah, you could bring in your own DNA evidence, and you could also, by doing so, really emphasize in the eyes of the jury, look at this evidence, look what it says. And I think Mr. LaDucer acted reasonably when he stipulated to essentially the DNA evidence showing that the profiles matched, got that out of the way, and reasonably focused his efforts elsewhere in terms of showing the absence of semen on Tyler's clothes, on the washcloths and the towels that Ms. Kelly had gathered after Mr. Sanders had allegedly cleaned up the boy.
The masturbating involved the mother as well, according to the story.
Depends which story of Mr. Sanders you follow.
Okay, when you say he admitted to masturbating, he admitted to having sex with the mother, and it was oral sex, and it ended up with masturbation. That's what he admitted to.
Yes. Well, ultimately, that's what he admitted after lying about it. Now, Your Honor, you had asked, Judge Reinhardt, I think you had mentioned before in an earlier question of why couldn't they bring in this stuff about what she had done before, about making this stuff up before or fabricating?
Well, I didn't refer to that specific incident. No, I referred to the sister-in-law and the stories that, about her general character.
Right. And I think the correct answer to that is that would presume that evidence would be admissible, and I would submit more than likely it would not be admissible under Evidence Rule 608. And
that's the same as the federal rule, basically, the Washington rule?
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's what the district court said is would be some unlikely.
Whether
it would actually be admissible.
Well, for what it's worth, and it may not be worth much, I've spent a fair amount of time in the courtroom, and I'd like to see you get that in, that character evidence in under 608. I submit that would be extremely difficult, if not impossible.
in the end, I mean, you can have this and a little of this and a little of that, but kind of to cut to the chase, it really rests on this Ryan hearing in many respects, doesn't it, in terms of this case?
I would agree with the contention that if the hearsay statements had not come in, then the state would have been left with minimal evidence with which to proceed to trial. In that sense, I would agree. But on the other hand, as I said before, for the reasons I've stated earlier, the crux of this case doesn't turn on Mr. LaDucer's performance as to impeaching Patty Kelly or not impeaching her, because there are other witnesses.
That's not the Ryan. You're saying that doesn't the whole Ryan calculus in terms of what the trial court would have done in make assuming the trial court went through each of these things mentally.
Yes.
That impeachment would not have been the death knell, you say, to the admissibility.
No.
Because it's her, not the child.
Yes. Right. She is the witness. She's not the declarant. And the indicia of reliability is to determine whether the statements themselves are reliable, not the person to whom they are made. And Ms. Kelly is the person, among Dr. Sterling and Detective Folsom, who are one of the persons to whom such hearsay statements were made. I see that my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rosen brings up a good point, you know, that I want to emphasize, is that when the lower courts looked at this, I draw the court's attention to the magistrate's R&R, page 25, and in it discusses Mr. LaDucer's unfortunate failings. But the point I wish to point out is that he focused on Mr. LaDucer's focus on the three witnesses, okay? I mean, that's the bottom line. And that what we're talking about here is we're talking about a situation of, basically, foundation. All roads lead to Patty Sue Kelly. She was the initial witness to the declarant statements. She was the one that had sole access to that individual for 24 hours. We don't know what happened, but the point that I'm trying to make here today is that in the context of the pretrial hearing, there was lots of things that that the trial court could have done. And I would call the particular witnesses, Daniel Sanders could have testified about, you know, masturbation and where, although there was some evidence that the court was aware of that. Mr. Dixon, Officer Denham, somebody to testify about where the DNA was found. I mean, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Rosen on this issue, because I think the missing DNA is critical, and I think that comes out in Mr. LaDucer's testimony, is that that was a real negative to the state's case. Why the heck he didn't interview the state's DNA expert on this issue is beyond me. But even more, I mean, then it goes to the issue of if he had interviewed him and found out that this issue of degradation was what the state was going to raise, then, of course, it would be absolutely critical to have a DNA expert to be able to refute another expert's testimony regarding the degradation. That is beyond me. I don't understand that. And to me, that kind of evidence goes right into the corroboration issue, which deals with the pretrial hearing. Because in the corroboration issue, the trial court expressly referred to the stains. But the trial attorney did not draw the trial court's attention to the nexus between the alleged act, what Tyler said about into various individuals, all of them about washcloths and clothing, and the fact that there was no evidence. I mean, that removes that nexus right out of the picture. And that is critical to provide physical, substantial testimony or evidence about physical or testimony about physical evidence that would go directly to the corroboration, combined with the missing witnesses that just...
Doesn't that go... You're back to the Ryan hearing.
Yes, but also in the court, of course.
It would obviously go in the trial, but at the Ryan hearing, would that in the end really go to the weight that somebody might want to give his testimony in light of the absence of DNA evidence, as opposed to its admissibility, which is what the Ryan hearing was, or reliability was directed toward?
required.
Well, the judge relied on it in his decision on the Ryan factors and subsequent on the corroboration of the Washington statute, where, you know, you if you go past the Ryan, you have to have corroboration. And that was one of the elements of corroboration. I'd listed, I think, four of them. And one of the issues that comes in when you look at Ryan are successive statements. Are they parallel statements of two different people? And so the point is, these are successive statements.
If in the end, as I understood the DNA expert's testimony, at least reading it, was you can't say that there was any. I mean, it's not have any plus side for the prosecution is the way I read it. Now, maybe I misread it.
I'll finish because you asked. I think that's a misunderstanding from my interpretation, let's put it that way. And the reason that it's a misinterpretation is because it was a critical element. And one of the things that having your own witness there...
Answer my question. Did basically he say you couldn't tell?
He did.
Right. So he didn't come in and say it's on there and it couldn't have been degraded. He just said, I can't tell you if it was or wasn't.
Right, and then it was subsequently used in the closing as a degradation argument by the okay. prosecuting attorney. Thank you very much.
The case just argued will be submitted.